we're lucky enough that we've got a kind of a north-facing slope, which tends to be a little bit wetter and a little bit easier to recover from damage. Whereas as you look across the way, you can see the slopes are bare, they're dry. Those are some of the issues, but we've got root wads here. We've got spruce tree revetments, which are along the, and most of this, the restoration is done for the toe of the bank where the water meets the land, and that's where your erosion, that interface is where the erosion starts. Mm-hmm. And also it gives the young fry a chance to have somewhere to hide. They like cooler waters. They like to, if you've ever watched a Merganser on the river, especially with all the babies, those fish are just, constantly under attack.
Yeah.
And I've seen myself, have a spruce tree revetment put in, and then like 2 days later, I'll go to check on it, and there's small fry all intermixed in there. And they scatter when I walk up, and pretty soon you start seeing them coming back out. So there's a huge benefit for that. And, most of the people think about the big fish coming back, and our concentration is more towards the smaller fry and the habitats that they have, because if we can get them to be the maximum size when they head out for the ocean, their chance of survival is that much better.
Right. That's the part of it that, insofar as we can control any of it, what that habitat looks like, and especially what that habitat looks like in developing areas, that's something that we can, if we want to, kind of wrap our hands around and try to give the fish the best chance possible.
Right. It was funny. I had a gentleman during one of the appeal processes when Mayor Navarro was here of the task force that was out. He had called me and he was not real happy about expanding and, having other anadromous waters and streams protected.
Right.
And he told me, he says, I'm a fisherman, commercial fisherman. And he says, I understand and I like to fish and that's my livelihood, but I don't like having somebody telling me what to do. And I mentioned to him, I said, well, if somebody puts in a culvert incorrectly and it's perched, which means that the fish can't move back and forth, mm-hmm. that you may have cut off, miles and miles of stream up above that were productive before and now they aren't. And with, the Kenai Peninsula being popular, that's a great place to be, as comes with that is development. Mm-hmm. And we just want to make sure that development is in a wise manner to keep the fish that we have.
Yeah.
And he kind of was with me, but I could tell he said, I'm not happy, but I understand.
Yeah.
So maybe the seed was there.
Well, when you're sitting in the manager's chair there, I guess, did you have any kind of notion 10 years ago when you started? And then, as you mentioned, 500-ish cases or permits a year that you're going through. How much outreach and sort of education would be involved in it? And is that something that was sort of on the table, or have you had to sort of develop a technique for doing that over the years?
And unfortunately, one of the kind of the, between the reduction in staff that we've had, before my time as being even a resource planner coming in, we did have an adult outreach person, and it was through a grant funding. We didn't have that grant anymore. We did have the Adopt a Stream with one of the Dan Pascucci used to be.
Sure, from the Watershed Forum.
Watershed Forum. We had a grant that we were administrating that the Watershed Forum got to go out and do outreach for the children. Unfortunately, that was called a CAP grant, which was Coastal Impact Assistance Program, that the borough, it was almost $2.1 million of projects, different projects for habitat restoration, outreach, and those types of things. That was done, and it was a great program, worked well, but we just don't have the funding, and there hasn't been any grants. That's one thing I would really look to in the future, try to find somebody that could do more outreach than what we have time for currently, yeah. Because that makes just a huge difference in people just being aware, because most people don't maliciously do something wrong. They just don't understand and realize what's going on. Mm-hmm. Case in point, I just had a gentleman that was mowing his grass, and his house, the roof line goes right towards the grass, then to the river, and he was having really bad erosion. And tried to explain that little buffer of having trees and roots can slow down that sheeting of the water, which mm-hmm. is what keeps it saturated and then causes erosion. So it's this kind of a cyclic, of the monsters that you create later become the bigger monsters.
Well, and it can be a little bit counterintuitive because, you know, for anyone who spends a little bit of time on the riverbank or maybe floating down the river, there are areas that when you go by someone's lawn and it looks real nice, man, it looks really nice. And they put a lot of effort into it and you think they're really taking care of stuff. And you go by other areas and you go, there's dead trees and everything's matted over and it doesn't look good. On some level, it can be a little bit counterintuitive unless, again, there's some outreach and you really dig into why a natural system looks that way as compared to something else.
Right. And those are those perceptions.
Right.
Mine looks beautiful. It's gorgeous. You mown grass.
I've done all these things to it. I put a lot of work. Yeah.
And if you look at, especially when I lived out in Dillingham, the Nooshkeck River was just an incredible undeveloped area. And the fish that were out there, I got to see the best of the best. And for that comparison, the Kenai River itself is doing pretty good. There are a large majority of the people, I think, really take pride and take care of what they have. And it's just one of those of some of these trees are, 100, 150 years old. You don't understand that you just took out 100 years worth of growth when you take a tree down. And it takes a while for that to come back up. So there are things that happen. Unknowingly, and that is one thing. And we've got some old photos from 93 before the ordinance came in, and it wasn't really developed much here, but I can do the comparison. And that is one big thing that I've noticed as both the resource planner and the manager is the amount of trees and that shade that's not where there as it used to be. Mm-hmm. So
I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves here, but are those things that when you can look and see long-term changes like that, is that something that you're thinking about in terms of a way to alleviate that or ameliorate that or fix that? Or how do you incentivize people to plant more trees? Are those the sorts of things you're thinking about kind of long-term?
Yeah, and I think it's the, again, the outreach to make those aware and they understand and they can just start on their own doing things to that point where slowly but surely they can make that change, whether it be a little 50-foot buffer or they make it larger, whatever they do. Or, I've had a lot of people say, there's bears around here. I've got grandkids. I'm scared.
Right.
And I talk to them about, just limb up the lower limbs so that you can have a good view. And I said, plus once you limb those up, your neighbors and everybody going by is going to see whatever's going on in your yard. And a lot of times I'll get that feedback of, wow, yeah, I didn't think about, and I strategically did, some trimming. Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of things I always get that smile when somebody said, well, you're the professional. And I take for granted what I know through my experience in years. And, the rest of the staff that's here is we have a lot of experience that sometimes we just think everybody else knows. And, most people have their other careers, their other, areas of expertise, and that may just not be one of them. So we try to help.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, and I'm glad you brought it up in that way. I'm curious, just ballpark estimate, how many site visits do you suppose you've done in almost a decade?
Oh, wow. That one's going to be, I'll put it this way, I probably can do, I would say, on an average of about 3 to 5 site visits a week. And that depends on, we've got the borough has a tax, benefit, that's our tax credit. And we, over a 3-year period for those types of things, the restoration projects that are, acceptable, there's on the land value or the project value, they get a tax write-off on that. So there's times when in the fall I've got to go out and assess those because those will go to the assessing department. They need the photographs and evidence that what they said was done.
Right.
And that is kind of the fall push and even towards because we need to have those done by January. And that's kind of our off season. Then there's other projects of site visits with DOT or HEA or any of the big agencies that will go out and spend time to look at what their project is. And then, of course, comes springtime. That's, it comes around February. Everybody starts thinking about their place up here or mm-hmm. they're here already and they're starting to kind of, and then there's the stragglers that about April, they're just like in a panic. So it gets crazy. And this year has been, kind of a little quiet. I have some concerns that we need to get out and probably do some more outreach just so people know, or, there may be just not that many things going on this year.
Yeah.
So But it's been steady for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up, you know, HEA and, you know, probably NSTAR and all these and the different companies that do business around here, because, you know, especially when we think about the River Center and it's in the context of the Enandromous Streams Protection Ordinance and the 50-foot setback and all that you do with private property owners, there's a huge world out there of gas lines and power lines and everything else going on. You know, I'm thinking about the NSTAR gas line that went underneath the Warren Ames Bridge a few years back and things like that, that yep. I guess when I think about the River Center and what its intended purpose is, I don't always think about public utilities, for instance. And there's a I would guess that's probably actually a lion's share of what you're processing.
Right. And the, gas line that went down to Homer, there was a lot of discussion with that. DOT, you know, we've been kind of neglected down here in the peninsula, from my understanding, on projects, and now we get an inundation of projects.
Right, we sure did.
You know, so it's those that if the bypass that's been talked about for years comes through, there'll be a whole slew of different things that, again, the agency's coming together, trying to work with that, and a one, you know, one-stop shop. We even do the conference calling in for those people in Anchorage, and so it has worked well, but so those are, you know, very time-consuming projects.
Well, and those are the big ones that people see, at right. least while they're being done.
Right. Yeah. Or have a benefit.
Or
right.
have a, yeah.
Yeah.
On the, but more on the private side of things, in going out to these sites, I'm curious, there have to be a couple of stories, some interesting kind of head scratchers over the years, and not to throw anybody under the bus, but again, maybe as a part of that outreach sort of thing.
Right. Well, and there's sometimes that you put yourself out there and, you know, there's, I can't talk specifically, but I'm sure some people have seen the last couple of years some things that went on and big projects, and they've come around to being a very good project. They, you know, it started out rough roads and we had to sit and watch, and it's turned out well and still has some little ups and downs. But one of the other that we had down on the close to the industrial area down by the mouth was doing a little different bank stabilization using concrete block, which is not usual, but it was going to be up above the tidal influence. It was an area that was highly eroded, had a lot of seeps in it. It was a difficult project. And it's always one of those, if it fails, then everybody looks at you and like, what were you thinking?
Right.
So this one was successful. You'd never know they were there. It's a bank is stable, and there was a lot of value, even historic value, of the facilities that were above this that were in jeopardy. It was about a 10-foot before the drop of the bluff. So those kind of things are the scary ones.
Yeah.
So
well, and those are sort of the meat and potato ones too. Those are the ones that those have really long-term impacts for sure.
And with that, and I think that one of the things that I take real joy in the relationships that I have with those people. You know, sometimes it's rough roads at first, and then you become kind of lifelong friends that they stop in and just say hi and have some ideas to bounce off of you.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of one of the concepts that we try, not only the borough, but all the other agencies, is to try to have that relationship, because once it goes sour, it's really hard to come back.
Yeah, it's hard to rebuild that. And again, getting back to that idea of this, you'd file this probably under other duties as assigned, this kind of public relations piece of it, right?
Yes. Yeah. And there's some characters out there for sure. And, you know, we had a gentleman that called in that he felt like somebody upstream just here had moved some rocks that were his favorite rocks. And we tried to explain to him that, you know, when the ice comes down, there's a lot of force and it can move a lot of things. But he was for sure that somebody had come during the low water and come in and got his rocks that he used to catch a lot of fish next to. So I don't know if we went on that one. He he calls in every so often still, though. So
just to check in.
Just to check in. Right.
Well, see, you know, in mentioning how many site visits you do and how many permits you process every year, and then how few actually get rejected for some reason, there must be a lot of, I don't know if haggling is the right word, but a lot of work back and forth to figure out a way that a project can get done, but also satisfy whatever portions of the code or anything else that need to be satisfied. And that is probably a big portion of it too, is just finding out where is that wiggle room.
Right. And working even with other agency, staff that have a concept of something that might be different, and to really look at, you know, the code of all of us and say, do we have authority to do that?
Yeah.
And we've done that both with landowners, DOT, HEA, you know, the other entities of that size to try to come up with something that fits into the code, because it really is one of those, if you start going outside of that, it's hard to then look at it and say, we are doing what we are charged to do. Mm-hmm. So trying to keep that in within the regulations that we have mission for, and also not step over our boundaries of authority.
Right.
And we currently have a project in Seward that we're looking at that now. They seem to have fulfilled what we need to do. And it's kind of the fact that we're looking at it, it's probably not the best idea, but they've filled all of the requirements.
And it's a shall issue and that sort of a thing. So,
right.
And that's, you know, something else that people don't maybe, or I certainly don't think about right off the top of my head, is that there's stuff on the other side of the peninsula that's coming through here too. And on the other side of the peninsula, that's a whole different can of worms, because Seward's always a moving and a shaking.
There's always something. And, you know, and that's why the 50-foot isn't down in that area, simply because of the way those streams react. It would be, we'd change it every week. So.
Yeah.
We those are some of the grandfathers of the ordinance were at least wise enough to know this is not a wise thing for us to go down and try to regulate something that's going to be more of a hindrance for both ourselves and landowners.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that, you know, the seagulls just came by that they're eating fish.
Uh-huh.
It reminded me of one of the things I wanted to talk about. It was a realization to me in Dillingham that where the Nooshkak River is, you go up on top of the bluff and it's just straight tundra. Everything's lush green trees. As soon as you get up on top, it's just tundra. And I realize the cycle of what's going on. The fish die, you know, the bear eat them, the seagulls eat, mm-hmm. and they deposit their waste in the in those little corridors. Trees and other vegetation can grow up. And then once you get outside of that, there's not a lot of activity, not a lot of, you know.
There's nothing to feed those nutrients into the soil and build soil that
correct.
Can support trees.
Right.
No, we're going to have to add, because I got to spend a summer in Dillingham as their fisheries reporter out there, and we'll do a little Dillingham talk. If you can imagine how much a part salmon is a part of the culture here, I mean, magnify it infinitely.
Yep.
for Bristol Bay. And are there things, you know, from your experience out there where salmon isn't just a commercial thing or a recreational thing or just even plainly a subsistence thing, it is a deep to the bones culture thing. Your time out there, did that inform sort of the way that you approach things on the Kenai?
I think it did. One of the things that kind of I look back on is the swallows would show up. And everybody, I worked with the Bristol Bay Native Association, everybody there would get all excited seeing the swallows. And it was like, okay, there are swallows. Yeah, I've seen them before. And they were like, no, the fish are coming.
Uh-huh.
And there's a whole concept in kind of that lifeblood of the fish and the systems. And, you know, a new summer and a season has passed, and now we need to start stocking up, you know, and it's on a more of a subsistence level. There is, you know, the commercial fishing, which is huge out there. And I see it here. I talk to people that they want to do the right thing on their properties to give it to their grandkids. You know, they want their grandkids to experience mm-hmm. this or whomever they're going to have, but that's the big one is the grandkids. And I see it in its own way, the same here. It's that tradition of the families here. We fish together. We enjoy a summer, and you know, either we're living here retired, or you know, the grandkids come down, or eventually that they get to retire and be on the river.
Yeah.
So, that's always that of, and I relate it to retiring because I'm kind of starting to understand that a little bit. Hasn't sunk in yet.
One just kind of dipping the toes in, as it were. Just I bet it hasn't really sunk in yet. I saw your desk. It's still full of paperwork.
There's going to be little sticky notes on all of those things that are unfinished. No, but that's what I hope. And I'm kind of in a very hopeful mode, because I've had a lot of inquiries from people that I think would be good for the position. So I think there's going to be kind of a good pool of candidates coming in for the manager, and I'm hoping that that really kind of works its way through, and that can be a smooth transition going into the next person that's going to be in charge.
Well, that's a great opportunity to talk a little bit about, with almost 10 years again, like we said, sort of in the driver's seat and all the things that you've learned. If you're filling out that application, or not filling out the application, but if you're conducting that interview and going through the candidates that might want to take over that position, what are you looking for? What makes it? Because there are those variables, those other duties as assigned.
Right. Yeah, and this position has very wide range of expertise, and then I don't know if I have many of those, but I tried. But it is kind of the understanding that it is a private property on most cases that we're dealing with. And it's to try to do somewhat of a salesmanship to let them understand their options. And it's not mandatory for them to do any of the restoration. It's totally on their own. There are certain things that we have if there is an issue of erosion and sediment coming in. But for the most part, it's a voluntary permitting process for them. And to try to have someone come in that has a background in natural resources is a very personable person and can work with the public in all kinds of circumstances. I'll have somebody come in that is very upset and not happy at all. And I think I talked to you when we talked about coming to do the interview. I had a gentleman just last week up in Cooper Landing, and I walked in and he was holding the door open when I was going to get an ice cream, and just had a craving. And
it's hard to not stop for ice cream.
I know. Uh-huh. And so I walked in and said hello to him, and I meet so many people. I knew I'd seen him, just couldn't put the face with the name and all that. And so he walked over to me afterwards and started talking, and I realized with his voice I understood where that was coming from. And case in point, he had a partner that was with him or had come in before to try to do this project. There was a little bit of a mix up on some of what they could and couldn't do. He's on a lake, so it's a little different. They came to me, I talked to them, got it all worked out, and we did some adjustments. It was it was a little bit contentious at first, but with that, we worked through it. They were happy with the results. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, I didn't realize it, but he bought me an ice cream cone. So I figured I'm on the right road now. It's time to go. So
and on a high note.
When you have, on a high note. There you go.
You have your people buying you ice cream cones.
That's right.
For...
That's it.
Well, it's so funny that you bring that up, because that does serve as a pretty, I would imagine, a very polar opposite sort of a bookend from when you started. And as you mentioned, when you started, the Anadromous Streams Ordinance had just kind of rounded out the 50-foot setback, and people were very upset about that for a lot of different reasons. And a lot of changes were made to that to accommodate a lot of those concerns.
Right.
But that's a big change in 10 years. And I'm curious, is it still the divisive political thing that it was 10 years ago? If things sort of cooled down, people sort of get it, I guess, for lack of a better term.
And the opposition came more because that was an addition of new streams and lakes.
Right. That, and that was the big pushback.
2010.
Yeah.
So what I saw out of that is exactly that. It was more of the people that were in those areas of the new regulations coming in and not understanding them. And we try to do the best we could when we get phone calls in before that all came about. And, it becomes a very emotional thing. Somebody now telling you what to do on your property. And I get it.
That's not why people move here,
No, it's Alaska. We're Alaskans.
That's right.
And I'm on the other end of that, just to my plans, is my wife and I have a place that's an in-holding within the National Forest, National Park, and which is even worse. Because they're more limiting than the forest, and that I'm on the receiving end of it now. There's certain things I can and cannot do with my, and I totally understand it, with this experience, it has given me the not giving up, but how can I make what I want to do workable within your regulation?
Yeah.
And I think that's where we come from here, is to try to get to that medium. And not everybody's going to be happy, but you can come to some kind of an agreement.
Yeah. So. Well, it's an interesting kind of a problem-solving exercise, I imagine, a lot of times, where you're sort of zooming out and going, all right, what's the ultimate goal? What are you really trying to accomplish here? Because, you know, just coming in without an idea or a plan and a bobcat might not be the best way to sort of figure it out, trial and error. And I'm sure there is a lot of that sort of zooming out. What overall are we trying to do?
Right. And a good case in point is DOT's working on the Kenai Spur. They're going to be taking some of the trees out along the roadway there to move utility lines and that. Then next year, they're going to be coming back in to do grading work to widen out. They can't do it all at once. So we looked at they're having to do revegetation. It didn't make any sense for us to make them plant, come back in and do the grading work, take those plants back out again. So we at least tell them, all right, we did stabilize the bank and then come back. And we've got it scheduled for them to come in, and we know the tree count and everything for them to come back and replant, you know, in 2020, so or 2021, depending on which how that goes. Mm-hmm. But those are the kind of things you use your best judgment to get a good product that's going to be acceptable not only in the environment but also cost wise, so that we're not causing extra cost for very little gain.
Yeah. So. Are there any examples of projects over the years where you kind of went at the beginning, there's no way this is going to work, but it did work out and everybody was kind of happy and you go, well, how about that? Are there any examples of that?
Well, there's one, you know, I'll at least say there was one on Dow Island that was one of those we looked at for a while. It was really somewhat contentious. At first they said we didn't have authority, and then, you know, it was this kind of a back and forth. Finally got it there, had a few issues, had one really big issue, and from that point worked with them to get to the point where we're at now. And I think it's been, you know, a lesson of for all of us in terms of those big projects, having the amount of time to spend on them so that they don't get out of hand. And also making sure that each step is done and kind of somewhat approved on as you go.
Mm-hmm.
We were there quite a bit, but there was just, you know, there's times when we just don't have staff to get up there. And some of that we counted on the rangers because they're always in the river. They would drop by and just kind of give a double check and then get back with us. And then we'd go do the work if we needed to make some changes. So, and that's the partnership. You know, it's not only just us in the office, but it's the rangers, it's the refuge, it's, you know, it's all of these different agencies and even, you know, the landowners for worried about something that's going on. Mm-hmm. And we take that as we need to make sure that we can say, yes, we looked at that. So, and I know you had an interview last week, or I'm not sure when, but with Mike Hill.
Sure,
And I wanted to kind of work that in. Correct. And he was talking about the fire.
Yeah, Mike Hill's one of the fire managers for the refuge, sure.
Right. And so we had it's been dubbed the Spruce for Salmon project. That was a new one this year that with the fire breaks that they're putting in for protection of property in the communities, that they were basically going in and chopping up all of the spruce and whatever else that's there and leaving it on the ground. And so this was an opportunity for all the agencies to come together to bring cut black spruce and white spruce into the river center. There was the refuge, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, ADF&G, and also the Kenai Soil and Water Conservation. It was a collaborative effort. And we put about 1,100 trees out here in the parking lot. And within probably 3 weeks, most of all that was gone.
Yeah.
And these were people that had prior permits, or at least they had to have a permit before they took the trees. They did it on their own or had a contractor do it for them. But I had several of those people say that I wouldn't be doing this year if it wouldn't be for these trees. So that's, you know, that cooperation is kind of one of those that it's nice to have other agencies and other people helping to look at how can we utilize this resource to a maximum.
Yeah.
So.
And you know, another story that I did from here recently, it was this spring, was, you know, there are 2-day workshops with, bank stabilization practices and those sorts of things. And I'm curious, I would love for you to talk a little bit about some of those programs, but I'm curious, you know, I'm sure there's always more room for things like that. And what would you see as, you know, where's an opening for something like that, perhaps moving ahead? Right.
Well, and that has been, it was the Stream Bank Rehabilitation Workshop.
Correct.
It's a day in the office, mm-hmm. At the conference room here at the River Center. And it's open to the public, to agencies, to whomever wants to understand restoration projects and how to do them. Either they're doing them themselves or they just want to know what a contractor should be doing. And then there's a full day out on the river at somewhere, a location that we've designated to do hands-on, putting the restoration project to them. And that was what they did here at the River Center a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And we had almost 40 people that came to the office and the workshop. Both U.S. Fish and Wildlife and ADF&G, their habitat division, does that workshop, and they do it throughout the state in different boroughs. Mm-hmm. So it's not just here, but we do help out as best we can and have the facility, which is convenient, and then look to see if there's not somebody that has a problem property that has multiple different techniques that we can use. So it gives everybody kind of that. The one they did this year was a property owner that kind of had inherited a lot of things, and this was like a 2-year working with them to get
how do you fix this.
And it, I think at the end of it all, they were very pleased with the whole concept and everything went on, but it was just another bonus for them to, you know, we're kind of the stick and the cost share is the carrot. I say it that way, but it really is a huge benefit to say, I know this is, you know, you've got an issue, here it is, but maybe this is some help.
Yeah.
And so it's totally different, separate entities doing each one, but the it is a very beneficial part to us is to have that partnership, and that's kind of some of the things I hope that the next River Center manager can look for, those opportunities of doing partnerships, mm-hmm. Whether it be through grant work or whatever it might be. And that the ADF&G has been working off of grant monies with the cost share program, and it sounds like some of that has started to get rough to find some shares. So
yeah.
So they were digging this year. It was and I'm hoping that program can work out to the best.
Yeah.
So, and one of the things that we're, where our cabin is in Missouri, and that's kind of
that's the one in the national park.
That's the one in the national park, and it's been in the family since 1920.
Before it was a national park.
Correct. And then my folks in, I think, 67 signed the scenic easement, which then mm-hmm. restricted that. But Missouri State actually has a tax incentive or tax sales tax that an eighth of that goes to some type of conservation. And then they have another tenth of it that goes to the parks and then also soil and water conservation. So the Missouri is very, in my mind, further along than a lot of states in terms of putting a priority, not only the states in terms of the legislative body, but also I think the people of Missouri have that of, we need to utilize this and have some nice things and access to rivers and whatever is, mm-hmm. we're going to have to put out a little bit of money.
So
it is one of the big benefits. That's one of the things with the borough. We have the tax incentive. We've got the U.S. Fish and Wildlife with cost share. So there are incentives up here, but it's kind of one of those that it takes
two to tango on all that stuff.
It does.
The people who want to do the project have to want to do it in that way.
Right.
For tall work.
Right. Yeah. Right. And, you know, it's the resource has always been here, and it's basically, it comes down to taking care of it. You know, it's one of those that's been fine on its own. So we need to do a little work to keep it that way.
Yeah.
Especially if we want to live right next to the river. And I don't blame anybody, as you can, you know, day like today with us standing here by the river.
There's a reason.
It can't be better.
There's a reason I asked if you wanted to come and stand down here for a little bit, because it is, it's really hard to beat, isn't it?
Well, my office is nice, but it's not this nice.
It's just a short walk away.
That's true.
It's just a short walk away. Getting back to that, this Stream Bank Rehabilitation Program, you know, let's just pretend that, you know, staffing is not an issue, funding is not an issue. If you could just, do you have an idea, like, ready to go, if you could start a new program like that for education or outreach or something? Is there some direction that you think that would be prime for it right now?
I think an adult outreach coordinator would be mm-hmm. one of those of being able to do some of the things we just don't have time to do, especially in that little peak of activity when a lot of the, even, you know, I don't know if they're snowbirds or just people from Anchorage that are coming down mm-hmm. for a weekend, is to try to get somehow programs that are not difficult to go to, but you've got them on kind of an annual basis or a weekly basis. So if somebody has time, they just kind of like, well, let's go see what this is.
Yeah.
And that's usually how you get some of those people that wouldn't come into the office and ask us, what do you guys do here?
Yeah.
We do get a lot of that.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm curious. This is a kind of a bigger question. When you look on the map along the Kenai River, so much of it is owned by, you know, state agencies, native corporations, federal agencies, on and on and on. I'm curious, from a developmental standpoint, how much room along the Kenai specifically, how much more room is there for development?
On the Kenai, there's not a lot of room left for private development.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much at its peak. You know, there's some state discussions on access mm-hmm. that's going on that might be a development on the state side or even the federal side, whichever, how that ever comes about. But the one thing that we keep close tabs with is the assessing department gives us a list of people that are, when a property changes hands and when it's on the river or if it's on the coast, they'll send us a listing and we'll go ahead and then just send them a welcome letter of, you know, welcome that this is the river center.
Welcome to the neighborhood.
Yeah. And that basically we'll put one of the literature in there for them to take a look at it. You know, I'm sure some of that just gets kind of tossed in the trash, but I think there are a lot of people that would look at it and think, well, let's go talk to them.
Yeah.
So you can actually see that in our numbers of permitting and numbers of inquiry. After we've sent those out, there's quite a bit of a turnaround. So those are the kinds of things that those are somewhat automatic for us. But I think with having an adult coordinator for outreach would be one of those that would be a benefit to getting the word out.
There's a phone number and a person that'll answer all your questions, and it's not you who's dealing with permitting decisions. It's not, you know, the mapping person who's doing something else. It's
And I've seen a trend of, you know, the original I wouldn't call them settlers, but the original bunch that were probably full-time livers of the, you know, along the river, mm-hmm. Homeowners that they are starting to get to that age that there's a changeover in hands.
Right.
And whether it be people with more, more affluent that have the money to spend because it's not cheap to live on the river. Property values are, you know.
They're doing just fine. I mean, you mentioned, they're going to be doing just fine for a while.
Right. And so with those changes in hands, those are the kind of people that we want to try to really hit with. And, you know, we can have them tear down take the trees out before we know it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get a phone call from somebody saying, hey, they just took down all the trees.
Yeah.
Rather than us approaching that and try to do a informative kind of planting the seed
mm-hmm.
to these are best management practices.
And again, getting back to zooming out, what would you like to do in your new backyard here? And does it involve, you know, whatever it might involve? Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, there's always been the gazebo that's up behind that we walked past when we came down to mm-hmm. the river. And the initial of that was to try to do some kind of group, you know, discussions, whether it be agency professionals to do a round table of how can we better do the management that we do,
mm-hmm.
Or even having the public involved to work with agencies to get to understand what the agencies do, or just have a one-on-one of what do you like, what do you don't like. Which can be crazy at times, but sometimes there's great ideas that come out.
I was going to say, but also pretty helpful, because if you have people all agreeing on the same thing, that maybe they wouldn't agree on anything else, but they agree on this thing, you go, maybe there's something to think about there, yeah.
Right. And then from there, to get into the political realm of talking to their assemblyman, because mm-hmm. that's kind of the start of all this, is mm-hmm. at that level. And I tell people, and they kind of just look at me like I'm just kind of brushing them off, but it does make a difference to let them know what your feelings are. And again, they start seeing that same trend. It's like, well, maybe we need to take a look at this mm-hmm. in terms of a legislative body to figure out, are we doing what we should be, or we need to do something different.
Right. And, sort of the concept of active homeownership is, in a place like this that's very fragile and that so much more depends on it staying healthy. And speaking of property values, I don't know how much property values would go down if there weren't any fish, but I can't imagine that they would be as high as they are now.
Yeah.
You know?
The river's beautiful, but the fish, I think, are the big thing.
That's right.
As we can see up at the Russian River and uh-huh. the confluence right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and I think that is very true. This would not be quite the same feel. And also, it's not only just nationwide, but it's international. You know, there's people that are come from everywhere to see the river. They've heard about it. And to have that be a piece of pride for all of those homeowners and all of the people around here, I think is a great thing. One other story I'll tell you is that there was a delegation from Russia that came over probably 4 years ago, and it was the first time I'd ever had a translator that I had to start my kind of the rhythm of having a translator.
Uh-huh,
and
yeah.
not, you know, I tend to talk a lot. So it took me a while just to be quiet. And so it was one of those that they were totally fascinated by what we were doing here. And it was the Kamchatka Peninsula area. They were the professionals from that area that had come over here to see what we did. One, they were really interested in our government. They wanted to know all of that, which I found amusing.
Email addresses and Facebook accounts and all that.
Yeah, locations. Then they were interested in how we got people to put money into doing restoration. And then also some of the incentives that were there for mm-hmm. people through the federal government or state or whatever it might have been. And it was an eye-opener of, you know, there's very similar things that we do. There's some governmental things we do totally opposite. But I saw in them the same kind of concern and dedication to doing restoration to help out habitat.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a very neat one of those career kind of like, wow, that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't expect those sorts of things to
right.
happen, and they don't happen every day.
Right. Yep.
In talking about, you know, how many spots along and the limited limited opportunities for development now along the river. Occasionally I'll see something pop up where as land changes hands, perhaps from a homesteading claim or something, into private conservation land. Is that something that is happening more often, happening less often? Is it a trend? Are people interested in it at all? Is there value in that?
There is. I think that there is value to it. I think it's kind of a steady, you know, there's some of those that don't have probably the grandkids to give the money, and they want to give to some kind of a something that they've enjoyed and to give back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's on a kind of an even keel. I haven't seen either direction of it increasing, you know, or decreasing. And it's one of those, for the most part, I see most families tend to transfer that to someone else mm-hmm. rather than having it put set aside and some type of a trust, a land trust or whatever yeah. that might be. I do see more land trusts that are being outside of river systems that are on some of the streams, some of the headwaters.
Yeah.
That they understand that those are the rearing, and those are kind of the key starts to everything.
And we're standing here on the Kenai. We've been talking about the Kenai, and it's all lovely and well and good, but it's not the only player in this little story that we
yeah.
are telling all the time. There's
right.
a lot of other things, and that's
yep.
we talk a lot about, you know, the 50-foot setback, but again, getting out into the broader floodplain, it's a lot has to do with those smaller streams, and
yep.
that probably flies under the radar a bit.
Right, and they're probably some of the most productive streams are up in those because of the alder, the amount of alder that fixes nitrogen, that has mm-hmm. the whole cycle of the invertebrates of the fish feed on and all that. And one of the things I look at way down the road some point in time with our changing somewhat different temperatures,
mm-hmm.
that some of those could turn into really prime agriculture areas. Mm-hmm. And we need to look at that of how do we both have agriculture and have streams and not have one fight the other mm-hmm. and we both lose.
Yeah.
So, you know, they found some of the peat bogs have little tunnels throughout them that the coho love to go up underneath there. There's no visible stream. And then all of a sudden they pop up in some lake that they don't know how they got there. And then now they're finding out there of these little corridors that
yeah.
are underneath there. You dig that up and cut that off, you don't know it,
mm-hmm.
and it's gone.
Yeah.
Just like a perched culvert.
It's Well, it's one of the thing about salmon that's fascinating to me is that over, I mean, in broad terms, they're a relatively delicate species. They need a pretty set kind of habitat. If it's too hot in the ocean, it's not good. If it's too acidic, if it's all these different things. But at the same time, in a kind of a narrow way, they're really resilient. I mean, you can if a braid channel switches a little bit by whatever cause, as you said, they'll find another way. They are pretty resilient. It's
right.
It's an interesting kind of a
right.
It's a conundrum almost. Yeah. What a tough fish, but at the same time.
Right. In the survival in numbers. You know, mm-hmm. there's so many of the eggs that are in the stream, and then that return is critical for the next, you know, 5 years of another or 7 years of another great return again. And it doesn't take much to destroy some of those different cycles, and it's gone for a while until another fish decides to go up that area that had been cut off at one point, and now it's back to being able to transfer fish through. Mm-hmm. And one of the biologists was telling me some of the coho are kind of wanderers. So some of these streams that have never had coho, and all of a sudden they wander up and they find another one that was wandering, and they have their little ones, and pretty mm-hmm. soon all of a sudden this is a new stream that comes up. And I think that happens all the time. And, you know, and I think also on the other hand of that, if a culvert or something happens, a beaver dam up the stream, it gets cut off. And I think there's always a natural balance there, and it's trying to make sure that what we do in terms of development doesn't tip that to one way or another. Mm-hmm. So,
and that's, it's so tough to maintain that balance because, and you were bringing it up, and I was thinking about this. I can't remember precisely what the issue was. I think it was having something to do with recataloging all the state's anadromous streams, all the fish bearing streams in the state. And one of the problems when it comes to development is that, I mean, practically every water at some point, if you have somebody there taking measurements, observing long enough, there's a good chance you'll see a fish pass through there. But how frequently, what kind, you know,
right, are they just wandering,
or is this an actual thing? Yeah,
right.
That's part of the hard decisions that have to get made, and it's right. tough to get that data to make those decisions
right.
too.
And you know, and Alaska is so vast, that's mm-hmm. and remote, that there are some of those areas that are just, you don't really know what's going on until it's all of a sudden happened.
Yeah.
And you find out much later of some of these things that went on.
Well, and that's the other one of those things, kind of like the salmon, double-edged sword, a little bit of a thing, because a lot of that data gets collected by companies interested in development. And we find out what's
right.
going on, and then we build something over it anyway.
Or at least take maybe some consideration of that and try to modify what's been going on.
Come to the River Center, see if
right.
you can work with everybody, get yep. a good plan together.
Right, exactly.
Well,
so there is that meld of, you know, the River Center definitely doesn't have a mission of shutting down development. It's more of, let's do this responsibly and try to make it to where we're coming to some kind of an agreement that will work, you know. And we don't have all the answers, but we try to at least do the best we can with the knowledge we have.
Try to accommodate.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I can't believe how fast time is going by standing on the river. It's funny how that happens, right?
Right.
In the last few minutes, I guess maybe, we talked a little bit about what you'd like to see kind of down the road and what you'd like to see in a predecessor. But I guess maybe just sort of parting thoughts. 10 years is, it's not a super long time, but it's a lot's changed in 10 years here.
Right.
Here on this little spot.
You know, it's one that I look at, not only that, just the career I've had up in Alaska itself, and the people that are here, the ability to see the fish that come through, and the kind of the unbelievableness of it all when you really think about how all this comes around and the whole cycle. And I think that's hopefully the next passing of the torch, is we keep those cycles as best we can with what we want to do and what we need to do as a state.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, is some of the parting thoughts I'll have with whoever might be coming in. I know I'm going to spend some time with them as they come in. Some of that will probably be after I'm gone, and I'll just be coming back because I do want to make sure this is a smooth transition. So, and I think there's some great things in the future that we can look at. There's going to be some challenges, as we all know. You know, why is this fish coming back? This one's not.
Mm-hmm.
And where does it go? What does it do? So I think technology is getting to somewhat catching up. that we might be able to get figure out where those issues or problems are and make those change and make people's mindset change maybe a little bit, whether it be commercial, whether it be recreational fishing, whether it be doing restoration work. You know, once we can kind of look at it and do some research with it to know this is what's going on, okay, we're correcting this little, you know, this little cut, mm-hmm. the 1,000 cuts. And so I don't think there's a silver bullet out there at yeah. all. But if we do every little bit we can, I think that'll make Alaska what it is and what it always has been.
Yeah. Well, I'll ask you, I guess maybe one, it doesn't sound like a tough question to me on the surface. I think this is going to be a tough question for you. Maybe you'll take a good bite out of it on your way out. Are we loving the Kenai River to death? We hear that a lot in terms of the development, in terms of the impact we're having on fish returns. Are we loving it to death, or are we starting to figure out how to love it appropriately?
I think there's certain areas that we concentrate impact, and it's not a good thing, whether it be restoration or erosion and, mm-hmm. and bank trampling, or it be either, you know, the commercial side or the recreation side of fishing or dip netting. We need to look at those and figure out, again, is that how much of an impact is this? You know, and then there's the political side of everything that comes in as to the other. So I think that we might be getting close to somewhat of a max on a little the load of loving, but I think that with people realizing it, there's a lot of discussion and, you know, and finger pointing, but that at least starts the discussion, mm-hmm. which is critical. Mm-hmm. If we don't talk about it, it goes by the way and we've lost it, if that's where it's going. But if we start talking and try to come to some kind of, you know, like the River Center, of some kind of agreement through us all to figure out, all right, who's going to have to give and take here. Yeah. So that's the best I can tell you without giving you a straight answer. Maybe that was, I don't know.
That was pretty good.
It wasn't pretty easy.
Well, Tom Dearlove, thank you so much for taking some time on a beautiful day out here and talking with us, and good luck in the future and happy retirement.
Thank you. And no fish were hurt on this interview.
Maybe after that. Yeah, now it's time to. No.
Thank you.